Welcome to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. In this hour, we explore the conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan a year after Azerbaijan had attacked the region of Nagorno-Karabakh, or what the Armenians call Artsakh. We will examine the possibility for peace, ongoing conflict in the region, and the growing authoritarianism out of Azerbaijan. But first, we interview Scholar Circle founder Maria Armudian, who's published a book on international human rights and the role that international lawyers have played at advancing cases against human rights abusers.
Human rights internationally are bound by the legal principle of national sovereignty, what we international relations scholars call the Westphalian system. What this means is that nations, countries, are the entities that are expected to protect human rights. But human rights are universal. We have these rights because we're human, not because we're American, Russian, South African, Nigerian. So how can international actors compel these states to protect human rights? As a legal issue, lawyers have played a creative and essential role at advancing the universality of human rights in light of really what's been a mixed record of national protections. Scholar Circle founder and personal friend, Maria Armudian, has written a wonderful new book on the role that attorneys have played in advancing international human rights. The book is called Lawyers Beyond Borders, Advancing International Human Rights Through Local Laws and Courts. Maria Armudian is a lecturer at the University of Auckland in New Zealand, and of course is the host and anchor of this show, Scholar Circle. Maria, thank you so much for being able to join us, talk about your book.
What fun it is to be on my, you know, program that now you are the host of.
Well, no, thank you. And it's an honor to be able to interview you, and it was an honor to be able to read this book.
Did you read the whole thing?
I have read the whole thing.
You're amazing.
The first question, you really portray an incredible creativity on the part of lawyers to be able to find courts that would consider themselves to have the jurisdiction to actually hear these cases. Just how creative have these international human rights lawyers been?
Yeah, so I think there are a few things to say there. First of all, from your introduction, you were talking about the Westphalian system and national sovereignty and, you know, all of these ideas, really. I mean, the book is as much about ideas and about how we have become, you know, we adhere to these ideas as if they are facts. And one of the things in researching this book is just how they become a reality until somebody comes along with a better idea, or maybe it's not a better idea, but is persuasive enough because of the creative way they have framed these issues and juxtaposed them against the problems of the day. So that's what is going on. The creativity aspect, I mean, the story of Peter Weiss is fairly well known in the legal circles, but not as well known in the rest of the world. I think one of the most important things here is to say that the story that I tell in Lawyers Beyond Borders is pretty uniquely American. And what I mean by that is that the civil rights movement, you know, was alive and well, and lawyers were using civil litigation to advance rights for those whose rights had been trampled upon. You know, you start, if you go back into, you know, the 1950s when they passed Brown versus Board of Education, for example, and they managed to get segregation declared illegal. As these rights were being built for one group, the lawyers would then say, okay, there are enough lawyers working on this area. There are other groups that also need representation and have had their rights also trampled upon. And so they kept looking for ways to advance rights for other groups. And these lawyers in the book are that of that ilk. They are civil rights lawyers. And Peter Weiss was in a unique position And I always say I had the great honor to interview him. He's in his 90s. He did this particular case that started this movement in the U.S. in 1979. The decision was in 1980. It's called Falardiga versus Peña Irala. Weiss was steeped in both movements, the human rights movement and the U.S. civil rights movement. And so he had this unique purview of the ideas that were fueling the international human rights movement. And one of those ideas was the idea of universal jurisdiction. This is key, right? Universal jurisdiction, of course, just means that some crimes are so heinous and so awful that they should be prosecuted anywhere and everywhere. And to him, he calls that the constitution of the world, part of the constitution of the world. So he just needed ways to test that, because these were all test cases in the United States to see how far they could expand these rights. Could he actually represent what they call foreign cubed, a case that was foreign cubed, represent people who were foreign? So the plaintiff is foreign, the defendant was foreign, the wrong was committed in a foreign country. And he thought, well, in some cases, it would fall under universal jurisdiction. How can I do that? So he and his colleagues at the Center for Constitutional Rights unearthed the Alien Tort Statute, which really was a simple law that the first Congress passed when they were talking about the jurisdiction of the judiciary, right? Like, what can the federal courts do? And they said, you know, aliens have access to our courts. The federal courts have jurisdiction when those violations, those torts, the civil wrongs, when they violate international law. And he thought, well, that is just a good, just as good of a, you know, universal jurisdiction statute that I could ever find. And so he tested it. And it was through the Court of Appeals that they said, yep, torture is one of those horrific crimes. And what had happened in the Falardiga case was that Juanito Falardiga was a teenager, and he was tortured to death by a military man in Paraguay. His father, Joel Falardiga, and his sister, Dolly Falardiga, had come to the U.S. looking for the torturer, Peña Irala, and did find him. They managed to find him so they could serve him papers and take him to court and get a judgment and then get him deported. Well, that meant that they weren't going to collect the $10 million judgment, but it did mean that they got him out of the United States, and they got a sort of declarative victory, a moral victory. They didn't get their boy back. You know, Juanito was dead and died a horrible death, but it was something. And that's what these lawyers have continued to do.
You raised an issue that I'd like to sort of explore a bit too, is in a lot of these cases, I mean, these are civil cases. So this, yes. You know, this is a civil court, not a criminal court, right. Which means even if the defendant is found liable, not guilty, but liable, the penalty is frequently a monetary penalty and almost never, except in some cases with corporations, almost never gets paid. And so you raise the question about punishment and of course, some notion of justice. Whenever I think of these cases, though, I wonder, is this really about discovery, about establishing legally what happened so that there is a narrative that, you know, in the case you cited in the Falardiga case, we know the facts now because it's been established in a court. Is that the primary motivation? So kind of a naming and shaming, or how much actual punishment can be attached to this?
I think, first of all, it's different for every plaintiff, right? For every survivor of a human rights violation. But I think that what has happened through this process, which started with Peter Weiss and then grew and changed and was creatively altered from that point until today by the follow-up lawyers. But one of the ideas that came out of this process was actually put forward by Senator Kennedy. And then it was put forward by a therapist who said, you know, One of the things that happens when people are violated egregiously, like with torture, is that their agency is just essentially destroyed. And part of this process actually is meant to restore agency. It's meant to transform the person from victim to plaintiff, and then to point a finger at their accuser and say, you did this, and have a court say to them, yes, he did this, and it was wrong. And that has some kind, for some people, a restorative effect. Now, if that person happens to have money, assets, and it's a big judgment, you know, a lot of times people who've been violated are not able to work in normal ways, you know, so it helps to put back together a life that might have been destroyed. And this would be the case, for example, in some of these indigenous communities where their lives were completely upended by, say, you know, oil exploration or pipeline infrastructure or, you know, all kinds of things like this, where, you know, they can no longer live the lives that they were living in their indigenous culture. Some of them were subsistence farmers because they can't grow anything anymore, but they've also been violated so badly that there's a sense of loss of agency and trauma, PTSD. So that I would say there are multiple reasons for this. And when they did settle with some of the corporations and some of the private contractors in the war on terror cases, there was monetary redress. And in one case, one of the violator had come to the United States and had won the lottery, and they got all that money. And so there are cases where there are assets. And so there is a punishment in a way. And yes, it establishes the facts for if there is a criminal prosecution down the line, that is one of the things that can happen. They can feed this into criminal prosecutions. But I think it's mostly victim-centered. It's mostly, you know, and also as the civil rights movement was trying to do, trying to establish law, good law that gives people rights. And so frequently, the survivors have nowhere else to go, nowhere else to get justice. Their own countries are not, you know, set up with proper courts. The international courts are not necessarily, you know, set up in a way that everybody's going to get, you know, properly heard. So this was just one additional route, one more pathway to justice.
You're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing international human rights and legal remedies with Maria Armudian, who's written a new book called Lawyers Beyond Borders. So Maria, one of the things that it's always been a concern of mine broadly, and your book raises this as well, is the role the U.S. has played as the jurisdiction, as this universal jurisdiction, in particular through the Alien Torts Statute. You asserted this question about universal jurisdiction, and what makes the ATS so unique is it has this universal jurisdiction, which is another way of saying Americans don't have to be involved in the case at all, as the plaintiff, as the defendant, and certainly not the location of the human rights violation for American courts to hear the case. How problematic is that? That the U.S. is, yeah.
I don't have a problem with it at all, actually, but the Supreme Court has had a problem with it. And that is why it has handed down some judgments that have said, the Alien Tort Statute needs, for these cases to move forward, it has to touch and concern the United States. However, that said, that has made it really difficult to, you know, confront corporations for their roles in these human rights violations. And there were several cases like this. However, in the 90s, started in the 1980s, actually, but by the 1990s, 96, I believe it was, Congress was actually quite excited about this concept of universal jurisdiction and passed, and George Bush the first signed into law, a follow-up statute to support the Alien Tort Claims Act. called the Torture Victim Protection Act. And so in this case, what they said was, you know what? We want to expand this to also include Americans who might have been harmed abroad. But also, we want this to be model legislation for other countries so that torturers have nowhere to go. And no matter where they go, their victims can find them and sue them. Well, that became law. And the issue with it is that you can take on individuals if you can find them and serve them papers and get them into a court of law. But that is where the corporate part does not get addressed at all. And they're frankly where the big problems are often. I will say, however, there was a big case against Syria that found Syria liable for, I can't remember how many dollars it was. It was upwards of $200 million. In the case of targeted killing of a journalist, of Marie Colvin, and her sister sued the Syrian Republic. And so that is a case in which the court did allow it to go through.
I know there's similar cases like Terry Anderson suing Iran for for being seized as a hostage. But one of the challenges here, when you mentioned contemporary cases, the Supreme Court heard a couple of cases, and actually we got the ruling in June of this year of two corporations that had benefited from child labor, Nestle v. Dole and Cargill v. Doe. And one of the challenges here seems to be that the court wasn't convinced that simply benefiting from the human rights violation is enough to punish the corporation.
Or hold civilly liable, because they weren't really punishing, really, right? They were just trying to hold them civilly liable.
Right. So, I mean, isn't that just one of the challenges generally? Go ahead.
Sorry. Again, it is the Supreme Court making law, right? And that is the issue of extraterritoriality that we were talking about earlier, in which the Supreme Court said, in order to use the Alien Tort Statute, the issue has to touch and concern the United States. And what does that mean exactly, right? So in previous cases, the lower courts, the appellate courts, had allowed cases to move forward when the decision was made in the United States, because that's the decision that, you know, then, especially if it was knowingly made that people were going to be killed or tortured or something like that, massacred. But this time the court did not allow that to be enough to touch and concern the United States. There are some lawyers that are really great who were subject to this book. One is Paul Hoffman, who teaches at University of California, Irvine. And used to teach at USC with you, Doug. But he's the guy who argued that before the Supreme Court. And he's one of the key lawyers involved in this movement and has argued so many of the cases, both before the Supreme Court and in the appellate courts, and understands the legal rulings with the nuances that me as a political scientist that I couldn't possibly get as well as a lawyer could.
Now, the book is... And you say this even earlier, you acknowledge this, it's pretty American-centric and this approach. But when you think of issues, and this actually was more, you know, a criminal prosecution rather than a civil case, immediately one case that comes to mind was the rather famous case of the attempt to extradite Augusto Pinochet, the former, you know, Chilean strongman, you know, dictator, you know, by the Spanish judge Baltasar Garzón. I guess one of the concerns with that, though, was, of course, here's Spain trying, at least a Spanish judge, trying to try a Chilean general. To outsiders, it looked awfully neocolonial. If you're not going to prosecute your own crimes, we'll prosecute them for you. How much is that a concern? Yeah, you said that you weren't as concerned because you wanted to see these cases brought forward. But there's clearly a power component in what country is actually hearing these cases.
So I think two things on that. There is that argument, but again, I think that we've got to heed the pain and suffering of the survivors. And if they cannot get any kind of justice anywhere else in the world, who is going to hear the case? Who is at least going to hear them? And so somebody has to step up. By the way, Spain doesn't do this anymore. And, you know, one of the lawyers in the book, Almudena Bernabeu, who's remarkable as well, she tried to bring a case for a woman whose brother was killed in Syria. And this was to get around the jurisdictional issues because Spain said, similar to the Supreme Court of touch and concern in terms of extraterritoriality, that the victim has to be Spanish. And in this case, the sister lost her brother, but they said it wasn't enough. So Spain's not even doing these cases anymore. However, Germany is doing some. So it is really interesting to see how far we go. Now, back to what I was trying to do with the book. Now, obviously, it's a political history, and it's a political history of a particular movement. And I focused on the Americas because I found it's such a profound effort to do something when nobody else was doing anything. But it's also, like I said earlier on, it's a story that is American in that it's about making rights. It's about building rights. And from kind of a ground floor or negative ground floor. And what does it take to build rights? You know, if somebody tests the case, if you can get an affirmative judgment, then other lawyers come on and they go, oh, well, maybe we can do another case. And then you get more and more lawyers and more cases. And then you've got a fabric of rights. And once you've got that fabric of rights, then you can go, oh, well, where else can this apply? That's what fascinated me the most. Now, of course, what you're getting at now is also that even these American lawyers, even Peter Weiss, was so frustrated, particularly with the war on terror, that he went abroad and helped set up an NGO to do similar kinds of things with universal jurisdiction, which is, and Germany was the place where he found the best statute. So it is happening to some degree in Europe. It's a completely different system. It's not the, you know, the civil litigation system that the Americans have, which we sort of evolved out of the Brits.
One of the developments that have come out of the ATS cases and what you're describing here has been this call for some sort of a universal court that can hear these cases. The International Court of Justice, of course, can only hear cases with nations withstanding, and the International Criminal Court, which has in many ways been politically compromised, you know, in some ways, they can hear criminal cases if you withstand this. Should the focus be on more, you know, more international jurisdiction, you know, perhaps through the UN system? I know there's been a couple of proposals, you know, on this. So an example for, you know, on corporations is, I mean, there's been a treaty that's been proposed at the UN for years, authored by John Ruggie, who just sadly just passed away. But the so-called draft norms treaty, yeah, that would give the UN the capability to at least, I mean, the UN can hear petitions, maybe even possibly be a court. I understand your argument that it's about political viability right now. And right now, you know, the US has offered at least an avenue, which is better than nothing. But should the legal focus be on trying to create international institutions that can hear these cases?
Look, I think that is important. And as you note, there are some politically compromised issues that arise in those systems as well, including at the United Nations. So yes, we should have international systems and we should find ways to limit those kinds of political compromises that are happening. But I think at the same time, creatively finding ways in other jurisdictions is fine. Finding ways to apply universal jurisdiction is good. And I say that again because it is not okay. It is not morally okay to leave millions of people without recourse and without redress. And the system right now, under the sovereign nation system, makes it nearly impossible for so many people to get any sort of justice, to get their lives back, to get their agency back, to get their bodies back. So something has to be done, and something has to be done kind of quickly. And so I think expedience is what drove these lawyers to do it in the United States. It's where they were, it's what they could do, it's the tools that they had. And so let's do something for somebody.
And by that really is the narrative of the book, is the use of these creative uses to find some form, some avenue of justice for victims. So even issues I'm raising is asking, is there a better way to do it? Not
probably.
It probably is,
but it would take a very long time, Doug. And I think that's what I'm getting at, right? Mm-hmm. You know, do you want to wait until all the victims are dead and have suffered and their families are suffering? And then there's, you know, all the sort of communal post-traumatic stress. And then, of course, there's the epigenetic transference of trauma. You know, it's like, how long do people have to wait? Do they have to wait for, you know, how long did John Rogge work on this? And he has passed on, and hopefully somebody will pick up the baton. But really, can we really expect something to happen like tomorrow? No. So there should be other ways that we can make a difference. There should be other means that people can get justice. And, you know, the American court system was one of them. And now it's not as strong. That might change. It could change. I hope it does. Because there are a lot of survivors that come to the United States as refugees. And you know what? Guess what? So do their torturers. They come here too, and they end up living here. And in one of the cases, there was a young woman she had taken refuge in Atlanta, Georgia, took a job in a hotel. And guess what? So did her torturer. The guy who tortured her was working at that same hotel. Now, how much peace does she get? Shouldn't she be able to sue him? With the Torture Victim Protection Act, she can.
And to end on a slightly, optimistic note, let's question here is, even those cases that I've cited from June of this year, the Nestle v. Doe and Cargo v. Doe, there was some expectation that the Supreme Court was basically going to throw the Alien Torts Statute out and say you can't sue corporations, though the victims, the children who are compelled to work, in these slave labor conditions on the coca farms, they didn't win. The court did not close that avenue off. And so I imagine you expect there's going to be more cases coming forward.
I don't know at this point. I know that one of the big issues that I touched on in the book is that these lawyers who do these cases are civil rights lawyers. And they have their hands full at home. They are having to take on massive amounts of police abuse cases, Black Lives Matter cases, and civil rights erosion at so many corners that it's pretty hard to then take on the international cases. Also, if they are going to be, if they're not going to change law for the good. So I know there's some contemplation among these lawyers about, where are we most useful? What do we need to do? So I think there will be in the future. And by the way, Brett Kavanaugh, in his previous job as an appellate court justice, did say that corporations shouldn't be able to be sued using the ATS. And so, yes, I think there was some fear that his thinking would end up being the ruling of the day. However, that said, in the Roberts Court, I think the strongest effort under Roberts is that he's trying to get as much agreement as possible. And so they're narrowing their decisions down to very small increments, even though they're upending so much of what I think the United States had been about. They are not doing it in fell swoops yet. They might with abortion.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so, kind of a line I love to give my classes is watch this space here. There's going to be some interesting developments. But the good news is everyone who is interested in these issues with just a remarkable detailing of cases, filled with narratives, filled with cases, and filled with stories of how wonderfully creative and committed these lawyers have been at trying to find some form of justice on these human rights issues. The book is called Lawyers Beyond Borders, Advancing International Human Rights Through Local Laws and Courts. The author is Maria Armudian, lecturer at the University of Auckland in New Zealand, and a host, anchor, and creator of this show, The Scholar Circle. Thank you very much, Maria.
Thanks so much, Doug. This was great fun.
Coming up, we explore the conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan a year after Azerbaijan attacked the Nagorno-Karabakh region. Stay tuned.
Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. 1 year ago this week, Azerbaijani forces attacked the region of Nagorno-Karabakh, or what the Armenians call Artsakh. This war redrew the maps of the region and shifted the power and influence in this region away from Armenians, who have declared the region independent, but legally it remains a part of Azerbaijan. Ethnic cleansing and the targeting of civilians in the attack mark the war. A pro-Azerbaijan ceasefire was negotiated with Russian troops serving as peacekeepers to oversee what's best described as a fragile peace in the region. What is the current status of the region following the ceasefire, and what issues remain, as well as the possibility of any sort of lasting peace in the South Caucasus region? We will explore this and the impact on the region, Anna Ohanian. She is the Richard B. Finnegan Distinguished Professor of Political Science and International Relations at Stonehill College. She's the author of The Neighborhood Effect, The Imperial Roots of Regional Fracture in Post-Communist Eurasia. She's also non-resident senior scholar in the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Professor Ohanian, thank you very much for joining us. The first question is, it's now been a year since the fighting began. What's the current status, the current conditions in this region?
Sure. Thank you very much for the invitation. It's good to be back in the scholar circle. The way the war has ended is a distinct category of conflict termination. Scholars who study armed conflicts distinguish between conflicts that end through negotiated settlements and conflicts that end through militarized victories, through war, and the terminology is victory consolidation. And actually, this particular ending of a conflict, at least in this stage, the conflict is not terminated. We should state that the key issue of the status over the disputed entity of Nagorno-Karabakh and the rights of the community in that entity are not discussed yet. But the mode of the way this particular conflict ended at this stage is quite telling as to what will transpire later on. In general, conflicts that end with militarized victory consolidation tend to deepen authoritarianism in victorious states. So this is based on large data of similar endings of conflicts. And we see this happening inside Azerbaijan, one of the conflict parties and the aggressor in this second war, 44-day war. The negotiated conflicts that do end through negotiated settlements all have a higher durability, more likelihood to last than any negotiated agreements to be implemented. Now, specifically for this conflict, since the conflict has ended with Russia broker trilateral agreement, As you mentioned in your introduction, the agreement was very, very favorable to Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan recovered the territory surrounding the Nagorno-Karabakh entity, as well as the southern chunk of the entity itself. So the ceasefire agreement also has a stipulation of unblocking the region. So with all of this, which essentially unblocking the region would connect Azerbaijan to its entity, Nakhichevan, with which Azerbaijan does not share a border. So to simply state that the agreement is quite favorable to Azerbaijan, but yet since ending the war, the Aliyev regime has been using coercive diplomacy in the string of issues. The list of coercive actions that he has undertaken is really long. And many analysts argue that in this stage, actually even its close ally Turkey has not been supporting Aliyev. In particular, the conflict ended November 9th. Hostages were supposed to be returned, but yet Azerbaijan proceeded and captured over 200 hostages and prisoners of war and continued to keep them as bargaining chips, asking for maps of landmines from Armenia. So that has been the negotiation between the two sides going on. In addition, Azerbaijan built a military victory park in doing a victory parade, and really Aliyev regime is trying to milk the victory for domestic regime issues as well. But the victory park really continued to dehumanize Armenians, which makes it very difficult to build any peace process moving forward. The Victory Park is complete with wax statues of Armenian soldiers, helmets of soldiers who have died. But most importantly, there have been Azerbaijani soldiers actually moved into Armenian territory in three parts, wedged themselves there, arguing that there's need for border delimitation. While technically I agree that there is need for border delimitation, this is a typical problem for the border between the two countries just reemerged after the Second War. So most post-imperial settings do go through border delimitations. And there are over 200 cases of border delimitation issues in post-Soviet space. However, this is border delimitation is a long process, decades long, usually carried out through civil servants, not through soldiers. So what Azerbaijan has been doing is very coercive, a lot more similar to, for example, what China has been doing in South China Sea than anything else. In parallel, there has been a trilateral commission formed by Russia, which includes governmental officials from Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Russia in order to work on the unblocking issues. But this process also has been quite secretive. And I believe that process has interrupted since Azerbaijan continues to stress Armenia's borders and Aliyev regime continues to make territorial claims on Armenia proper. To sum up this section, Azerbaijan has been insisting on peace on its terms, meaning that we will recognize Armenia's territorial integrity if you consider the conflict as ended. You recognize Azerbaijani territorial integrity, meaning that you do not speak of Nagorno-Karabakh anymore. This essentially what I call the tyranny of territorial integrity. While it is an international principle, international law, but at the same time, so is national self-determination and minority protection is hugely important. Studies do show that since 1970s, armed conflicts have been declining in parallel. There's a correlation between the decline of armed ethnic conflicts and in general onset of ethnic conflicts as accommodative capacities of states increase. And accommodative capacities include the measures like federalism, power sharing, territorial autonomy, to name a few. So simply concluded territorial autonomy without minority protections will continue to stress the international system, introducing further points of instability.
The Russians are supposed to play this security guarantee role. And then there was some expectation the Russians would at least provide some degree of security for Armenians who had been kind of laid completely open, completely vulnerable to the Azerbaijanis as a result of Armenia's loss in this war. Is Russia not playing that role, or are they basically, are they taking a bit more of a backseat, or is there an expectation that Russia is going to play a pretty significant, pretty aggressive role?
That's a great question. So to clarify, Armenia has had actually not only bilateral security arrangements, agreements with Russia, but also Armenia is a member of Russia-led CS Collective Security Treaty Organization, Russia's answer to NATO, as well as Eurasian Economic Union. So Armenia really pushed and essentially aligned its security with Russia and Russia-centric institutions. During the war, Russia did not get involved, while Azerbaijan's main ally, Turkey, supported Azerbaijan in a very big way by supplying mercenaries, drone technology, military, political engagement, etc. Russia did not pick a side. I would argue that in this respect, Russia behaved in a more imperial way, not choosing a side, playing one side against the other. Arguing that Nagorno-Karabakh issue does not fall within Russia's security umbrella with Armenia, that it is not Armenia's border that is threatened. Okay, so far so good. I can see the argument. But since then, you're absolutely right. Azerbaijan has stressed, essentially, soldiers have entered the border in three places, and they actually do shoot on the international border. I actually drove through that area. Civilians are terrorized. And Russia has not, but I have seen Russian peacekeepers in Armenia in the southern part, but there are not that many. They are not that visible. I would argue that even though the international community recognized Azerbaijani coercive, quote-unquote, delimitation, border delimitation claims, arguing, pushing for Azerbaijan to move back, only Russia, Armenia's ally, stayed on a sideline and said that we need to form a committee, et cetera, et cetera. So I cannot say with confidence whether Russia does not want or is unable to provide the security that Armenia is entitled through various political and military treaties signed with Russia. I do think that we tend to overestimate Russia's control over this region. This is a fractured region, divided, and in this respect, while imperial powers or hegemonic powers will pursue this regional fracture to project their interests globally, at the same time, these fractured regions are also a liability. I don't think Russia is able to fully control Azerbaijan. Even though others will argue that Russia is doing this on purpose in order to pressure Armenia, I'm not sure, because I think by not standing by its security commitments. On the one hand, yes, it continues to not pick a side. It has all kinds of economic interests with oil-rich Azerbaijan. It's still a huge market for Azerbaijani products. But at the same time, its role, its claim as a security provider has been damaged tremendously. Mm-hmm. And if the agreement stipulates that Russia is support to provide, to be the broker, to be the security guarantor when the region is unblocked, it'd be very difficult to rely and trust that Russia has the capacity to do this.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the post-conflict conditions in the South Caucasus, the conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia, with Anna Ohanian. So, you described earlier the way in which this military victory has entrenched authoritarian tendencies on the part of the Azerbaijani leadership of Aliyev. Is there also the same sorts of concerns, or at least the undermining of some of the legitimacy, certainly the popularity in Armenia? The Prime Minister Pashinyan really was kind of blamed for this war, and Armenia is a pretty relatively new democracy and a certain degree of fragility. Is there some real fears for democracy in Armenia as a result of this conflict?
Absolutely. Studies do show that heightened security environments, wars do stress democracy. They can produce democratic decline. So there's all kinds of research on the relationship between security and democracy. And as you noted, Armenia's democracy last year was only 2 years old. It was very nascent. What transpired since signing the ceasefire agreement was something significant. There was immediate backlash against the Pashinyan government for signing the agreement. It should be noted that the groups, while the public was overwhelmingly frustrated and traumatized and very upset with the way the war has handled, all kinds of questions were raised, but the political crisis on the streets, protests were carried out by groups that were already, they were left out of the post-Velvet Parliament after Armenia went through its democratic breakthrough. Some of these forces were calling, and this was very, very dangerous few months. Some of these forces were calling for the formation of so-called technocratic governments or for essentially transitional governments, temporary governments. This would amount to a grabbing of power through the back door. These are the forces that were not elected, that were actually excluded from the parliament. Some of them aligned with the previous authoritarian systems. But what are the demonstrations, ironically, they did not grow in numbers, even though the public was upset. This really indicated that these groups did not have enough public support, but they have made enough pressure for the Armenian political system to move towards snap elections. And this, I think, needs to be emphasized, the fact that Armenia succeeded in addressing, solving its political crisis institutionally through the ballot box. I think this was a sign of maturity of Armenian democracy. In parallel, there were political protests in Georgia. There was a political crisis in Georgia as well at the same time. And yet, in the case of Georgia, Europeans had to negotiate between the two political parties. So the fact that the snap elections took place and some of the forces that were protesting succeeded in managed to find their way into the parliament, even though it's much smaller presence, but still they're there, which I think is good because now their discontent moved into the institutional settings. So in that respect, I would say things are, and to add to that, one person that was the key challenger was Robert Kocharyan, Armenia's second president, who has a painful legacy in Armenia for very violent handling of post-election protests in 2008 as a result of March 1st event, as a result of which Armenian citizens were killed by the military. Now, him campaigning, on the one hand, this would not have been the first time when the previous elite becomes elected in the new democratic parliament. This is very common. Over 75% of democratic transitions in the 20th century have produced these outcomes. But he was campaigning specifically to undo Armenia's, essentially limit Armenia's civic freedoms. He was campaigning on that quite openly on the grounds of security. In short, there was a very clear security versus democracy choice, a forced dilemma, which I do think is a false choice. But that fear of returning to any authoritarian system or losing the new political freedoms also played a role in Pashinyan's favor. Even though people were frustrated with him, they still ended up voting for him because they did not want to return to lose their democratic openness. So I think that's also significant that Armenia's democracy held pretty well.
Now, I know one of the concerns Armenians had was during the conflict was kind of the way the United States seemed to be pretty disengaged. A reminder that the Minsk group, really the US, Russia, and France, had been monitoring this region since the initial conflict, you know, had ended in the early 90s, 94, I believe it was. And the U.S. didn't do terribly much. Has anything changed with respect to U.S. foreign policy? Because, I mean, that obviously takes place under a different administration. Has the Biden administration taken any renewed interest in the region?
Well, Biden administration has been, in general, signaling that it is willing or is eager and interested in standing up for democracies in general, but also in standing up for human rights in general. So in the current post-war situation, a Russian peace, what I call it Russian peace, Russia brokered agreement, is pretty much in the hands of illiberal players. The outcome was coercive, continued coercive actions on Azerbaijan's side is unchallenged. These are all markers of what we call illiberal peace building. And they're dangerous in this. But there's still opportunity for OSCE Minsk group to revive and expand its role. And United States has declared, as well as the US ambassador in Armenia, Ambassador Tracy, has been several times stating that this conflict is not resolved, contrary to what President Aliyev insists, meaning that the crux of the issue, the status of Nagorno-Karabakh, the fate of the population in Nagorno-Karabakh, Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh, this minority, is not settled. There is room, and I think there's room for the United States to engage through the Minsk group. But I think at the very least, United States could really push Azerbaijan on at least all of these coercive actions that it is carrying out. Biden proceeded to continue with the military aid to Azerbaijan despite gross violation of human rights and war crimes. Now there's another efforts within the House of Representatives to essentially push back and really make it impossible for United States to provide military aid to Azerbaijan. So in this respect, I think there is a lot of, as United States is disengaged from Afghanistan in a very spectacular way, stating that it does not want to be the world's policeman. But at the same time, I hope it has been kind of swinging from one extreme to another. There are a lot of, Nagorno-Karabakh is a case of the middle ground. So much that United States can do in putting its political capital pressure on finding a sustainable settlement on this conflict, because unresolved conflicts are front lines of authoritarianism. The longer this conflict remains unresolved, the higher the stakes of authoritarianism in Azerbaijan are going to be. And the regional resiliency will not be improved in any way. So I think there is a sure between isolationism and full-blown military intervention. There are a lot of things that the United States can do. And Nagorno-Karabakh is a good case in point.
We've got a couple minutes left. What's the possibility that this is a conflict that actually can be resolved via a stable negotiated settlement, as opposed to kind of an expectation that since Armenia lost this war, that Armenians are rearming themselves and fully prepared, you know, to have another round of fighting? So is there a way that there could be some sort of stable resolution that both sides would agree to and could actually bring peace to the region? Or is the most reasonable expectation that there's actually going to probably be another round of fighting?
Many are worried that fighting might be renewed. The only mechanism for that to happen would be if the border escalation continues. If Aliyev continues to pressure the border, I see that as a mechanism. But for Armenia to rearm itself and engage in this revanchist war, I don't consider that likely. As a democratic states do need the openness. They do need economic prosperity. And wars kill both. So I don't expect, and after the war, Armenians are traumatized, but I don't think that they're ready for another round of fighting, or that they want another round of fighting. So I don't the negotiated settlement is the only outcome. This is an internationalized territorial conflict in terms of its type, the way scholars of peace and conflict research it. This particular types of conflicts are harder to negotiate. That is absolutely true. But at the same time, they also resist full-blown militarized final resolutions. Considering that this conflict has emerged as a part of Russia's geopolitical calculations, Turkey's geopolitical calculations, and Iran is also watching for a variety of reasons, the only solution is to find a negotiated settlement to this conflict. So far, I do consider Aliyev regime as the main driver that roadblock towards negotiated settlement. And he has purely domestic regime survival issues. Azerbaijan will be going through energy transitions, and that is really what's driving Azerbaijani the behavior of the Aliyev regime. Declining oil prices, the end of oil.
We've been discussing the conflict in the Nagorno-Karabakh or Artsakh region between Azerbaijan and Armenia. 1 year later, a year ago, the fighting had started. The post-conflict challenges the countries face and the ongoing conflict within the region. Our guest has been Anna Ohanian. She's the Richard B. Finnegan Distinguished Professor of Political Science and International Relations at Stonehill College. She's the author of The Neighborhood Effect, The Imperial Roots of Regional Fracture in Post-Communist Eurasia. And she's also a non-resident senior scholar in the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Professor Ohanian, thank you very much for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you.
I'd like to give a special thanks to the Scholar Circle team, Maria Armudian, the host and anchor, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongri, webmaster and production assistant. All Scholar Circle shows are archived on scholarcircle.org. You can find our podcast on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle Twitter account, and please join our Facebook page. On behalf of the Scholar Circle team, I am Doug Becker. Thank you for listening.